Hey, welcome to the Digital Communicator Podcast. I'm Hemming Nelson.
And I'm Brian Castle.
And Brian, we had a great conversation with Dr. Digipol himself, Dr. Alan Rosenblatt. Did you learn anything?
It sounds like Alan's been using the internet since before I've been alive. You guys are talking about, you know, running campaigns, working for internet companies when I think I was first getting online. So yeah, it was it was a lot of fun to see the evolution and see actually how things have evolved almost exponentially. It was kind of a relatively slow start.
Burn.
And then just the way campaigns and tools have changed in just the last 5 to 10 years.
Well, I think we could probably put this one out as a massive online course. It was definitely educational, and of course it was lubricated. Today's lubrication was Dogfish Head 60-minute IPA, and that was provided by
Charity Engine. If your CRM is driving you to drink, give Charity Engine a call.
And here's our conversation with Dr. Rosenblatt. So yeah, you just gotta keep the microphone sort of close to you. So if you're gonna lean back.
Pretty good, right?
It's like Passover. I lean. I get interviewed while leaning because I'm a free man.
Free man.
I don't get it.
On Passover, you're supposed to sit with a cushion so you can recline while you eat, because slaves ate crouching without being able to rest, because they would crouch, they'd eat, and then they go back in the fields.
I've never heard that.
It's
one of the four questions. Why is it on all other nights we eat sitting up, but on Passover we eat reclining?
It's not because, like, lots of...
Really? Mm-hmm. I don't remember seeing that in the Kiddush. What's it called?
The four questions. Yep. It's one of those key ones.
Is that what you tell the stupid child?
There's an answer.
The 10 plagues. I thought it was three questions.
Manish Jana, there are four questions, fear questions, and each one has an answer for the stupid child, for the selfish child, for the naive, you know.
Right.
So wait, you're not joking about the stupid child thing?
No, it's in the book, man. It's in the cartoon book.
They have answers written
for dinner
for children who are stupid or, you know, young and don't know any better.
Yeah,
questions for the selfish child who says, "What is this that you're doing?" You know, and they exclude themselves. You know, you're doing this, not me.
Yeah.
You know, that's the...
Do children get to see this book? That's like a cheat.
Well,
like,
yeah,
the whole
idea of the four questions is the youngest child who is able to, at the table, ask the questions.
I feel like you're talking about leading. That makes me think of somebody once tried to tell me that the term hipster came from people smoking hookah and, like, leaning on a pillow on their hip.
Oh, interesting.
And now I wonder, are all Jewish people hipsters?
Well, of course.
On Passover.
Tragically hip.
Tragically hip. Or doing it before it was cool.
Yeah, Ben Barnett and I were tragically hip 15 years before the band existed. And before any hipsters were... Back in the 90s, we were doing tragically hip stuff. You know, we were hipsters back then.
So we're talking to the hip mensch, Dr. Alan Rosenblatt, today. And today we're going to dive into something which is near and dear to your heart, which is sort of the history of digital or online advocacy. What is the term that's used in academia for that?
Academia? Academia uses ICT.
Information superhighway.
Information communication technology. And it just irks me every time I see academics use that phrase, because nobody in the practical world uses it. It's a purely academic phrasing. You know, we talk about online advocacy, internet advocacy, online engagement, online campaigns. That early on, it was very much like that. And now, finally, we've reached the stage where it's, you know, advocacy campaigns, which have both an online and offline component that are integrated together.
Yeah. So the communications medium is no longer the important thing. It's what the message is.
Yeah, you know, there's been this process where, you know, early on it was like, you know, the digital campaign was different from the campaign, and then the digital strategist got a seat at the table, and then there became a campaign with digital and an offline on online components to it. And now we're kind of going through it all over again with social media campaigns being the sort of the bastard stepchild again. Mm-hmm. And for the older generations, they still think of media and social media as separate. But for millennials, I think, you know, they look at it and they go, media. It's all the same. It's social media, online media, offline media, earned media, television, broadcast media. It's all media. And it's, if you look at the way the presidential campaign has worked out this year, the only candidate that has embraced it at that level is Donald Trump. And look where it got him. You know, he's now...
I thought you were going to say Bernie Sanders.
No, I mean, Bernie Sanders sure has a really strong digital team that really has, you know, Scott Goodstein and Revolution Messaging and Tim Tegaris, who Scott was Obama's 2008 social media person, and Tim was Chris Dodd's guy, and was, you know, big, was the pioneer that put together the original sort of dream team over at SEIU under Andy Stern doing digital campaigns. So, yeah, they do great stuff. But Donald Trump goes the extra step, because when you engage with Donald Trump on Twitter,
you engage with Donald Trump. Yeah, unfiltered.
And you know, I always talk about the relationship between social media, politics, and political efficacy, the sense that both internal efficacy that politicians and government responds to me, the individual, and external efficacy that it responds to the people in general. And I find that the more politicians and elected officials and government officials use social media, the more they create a sense from the public of both internal and external efficacy, because not only do they see individuals interacting with politicians, but it's happening in a public forum, so you see other individuals interacting and the potential for you to interact there, and so it hits both sides of that equation. And I think campaigns where the member or political offices where the actual politician, the actual official, is on social media themselves take it that whole nother level of truly connecting with the voters on a very interpersonal level. And so that gives you the Donald Trumps of the world, the Claire McCaskills, the Keith Ellisons, the Cory Bookers. You know, Cory Booker, when he was mayor of Newark, used to, during snowstorms, would say, tweet me where you are. If your car is stuck, I'll show up with a shovel.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he did.
Yeah, he's going to be the next Obama. I think...
Corey's a
guy. Yeah.
May 2nd.
Corey's great, and he's smart, and he's just, you know, he's got the whole thing down.
Well, the reason we're here is to talk about sort of the history of all this, because you've had a front seat basically from the beginning of the internets and the interwebs.
Yeah, yeah.
And on through up today, and you're still pretty active in that space. Who's the very first politician to embrace the internet?
So
is it Al Gore?
Well, Al Gore, so the joke is Al Gore invented the internet. The truth is that Al Gore was instrumental in making sure that the internet got the funding it needed to
DARPA.
Expand. DARPA in early stages. And
his position was... late 80s, early 90s?
Well, DARPA was started in 1978. I was just listening to Vince Cerf speak at the Italian Embassy last week.
You're talking about DARPA, the department within the Department of Defense, or you're talking about DARPA, the network?
Well, DARPAnet was created by DARPA, the office within the Department of Defense, but it was originally set up
as an... Are we going back too far?
Well, not completely, because, yeah, you know, it was originally set up for academics to share their research and to interact with each other. And I think that when it comes to policy advocacy and when it comes to policy formation, academics clearly play a role in working out which policies will work and which ones don't, testing the ones that do, and, you know, testing the ones that are implemented to see if they'll work and if they've succeeded. And so from that perspective, the early days of the internet where academics were sharing their research in a way that allowed them to move research faster allowed us to have a quicker turnaround on evaluating the effectiveness of public policy, of developing alternative public policies to what there were. So I think that those are, in many ways, the roots of digital advocacy and digital politics because of that. Mm-hmm. But so that's 78, and then, you know, in the 80s, you know, it becomes much more popular, but it's still all very text-based. My understanding is that as early as 88, 89, IDI, which was a spinoff from AT&T, basically argue, or Bell Atlantic even, was claims that they were doing email advocacy even before the web was launched. I haven't seen the exact, but I spoke with somebody who was part of that team, and he says, oh yeah, we were doing that early on. But of course, the World Wide Web doesn't come around until 1993, and that's when it was launched. And for me, I had already been doing work on presidential use of television to manipulate public opinion for my dissertation, which I finished in the fall of 1992. I'd been doing work with the internet and sharing of research information. I had come up with this cockamamie idea in 1984 of kiosk-based custom-printed magazines based on subscription profiles on a card that you would put in, like an ATM machine. I was enamored by ATM machines, as most first-year college students were back in the 80s. It was very dangerous. And I thought, oh, you know, you get a subscription profile, you put it in the machine, and it would print your magazine custom on glossy paper. You could add a la carte articles that were not on your profile. It would charge your card. And then you would get this glossy paper print, color ink, saddle-stitched, folded, and spit out of the machine. There's your magazine. And I was advised that that was too... careers, technology, or content, pick one. And I went the content route, got my master's and PhD in political science. And then 1993, when I see the World Wide Web, Mosaic, the first web browser, all of a sudden I go, ah, I made the right choice, don't need the kiosk anymore.
Yeah.
The web and a color printer does the job. Or who even needs the printer?
My first introduction was downloading the New York Times in PDF, probably 1994 or something.
Yeah. So early on, you're getting that that really revolutionizing, democratizing of information and access to information. So 1993, the web is born. 1994, Diane.
Brian, when were you born? Were you in junior high at this point?
This does not feel like a safe space to answer this question. I feel like I'm going to get jumped and be labeled a millennial so instantly.
Yeah, well, you know, if you are, you are. There's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah, you know. 84.
The millennials rule the world now. Didn't they just become the largest demographic group?
Yeah. So 1994, Dianne Feinstein becomes the first congressional campaign to have a website.
Not Kennedy.
Kennedy becomes the first sitting member of Congress to have a website the same year.
Wow.
Okay. So, and Chris Casey, who we were talking about earlier, Chris was a staff person at Kennedy's office, and he got a call from the MIT Artificial Intelligence Lab saying, hey, we'd like to build the senator a website. Would you like that?
Nice to represent Massachusetts.
Of course.
Call the guys at Harvard and the guys at MIT.
You know, you got to go to your homies. Although MIT just doesn't really ring that way. But MIT builds a website that was actually hosted on MIT servers for Ted Kennedy, became the first member of Congress to have an official website, whereas Feinstein became the first campaign to have a website. 1994, also edemocracy.org, which at that point was called Minnesota eDemocracy, created the first election web portal website with all sorts of information and access to polling and results for all the elections. Many years later, I joined the board of directors for eDemocracy and still sit on that. So it's a nice little – that was Steve Kliff's brainchild.
Mm-hmm.
So those are sort of the first three. Then there was Project Vote Smart, which was collecting surveys from candidates about various issues and putting that online. And
is it having an impact at all at this point, though?
It's a novelty at this point, right? And it's starting to. But very quickly, you know, 1996, the first presidential candidate gets a website, and that would be Pat Paulson, the comedian, who beat Clinton and Dole by about a month. and when they got their websites up. The first political satire website, maybe the first, came up, which was satire on Dole, which was basically making fun of the fact that he was named after the pineapple and banana company, and started, you know, talking about how he prefers bananas that are slightly overripe, but not so overripe that they become too mushy and things like that. This was like on the homepage of the Dole parody website, and so that's the that's sort of the early days of it. But within a couple years of that, I think 96, 97, CapWiz comes out. And CapWiz is the first...
That soon.
Yeah. And CapWiz is the first off-the-shelf tool for emailing your legislator based on your address or zip code. And the story for that is great because initially...
Have they done any innovation since that time?
Has CapWiz done it? Well, CapWiz got bought by CQ Roll Call, and you know, and they tried to build a new platform called CQ Engage, but I think they've sort of given up on the innovation side of that. But CapWiz was interesting because Capital Advantage started out as a publisher that would publish the Congress little skinny Congress books with all the directories of the members and their staff and phone numbers and all that stuff. And one of their and then they would white label the book for your conference or for your organization. And one of the early events that they or clients that they had was C-SPAN. There was a guy at C-SPAN named Barclay Kern. And Barclay was working with Bob Hansen over at Capital Advantage, who owned Capital Advantage, and said, hey, why don't we put this online? And so they put it online, the directory. And then they said, hey, why don't we make it possible for people to send emails from this online directory? And CapWiz was born. And fairly soon after that, Barclay leaves C-SPAN and goes to work for Capital Advantage.
What are we talking about?
96. Okay. So 96.
At the time, I was working at the Washington Post, and I remember getting the DVDs of the directory, which was a huge improvement.
Right.
Advance over.
Right, because then you could put it. Then you had searchable. All that stuff. You know, anytime you start moving things onto the computer, you get all the searchable capabilities. You get the ability to have a lot more data, a lot more information without it becoming unwieldy. And then once you put it online, it becomes accessible.
Yeah.
And then once you put it online, you can then connect it to email, connect it to, you know, beyond that, Capital Advantage, CapWiz, not only connected it to email so you could email, but then they connected CapWiz to Thomas. And this was amazing because with Thomas, which is the Congressional Research Service's online service of all the bills that are being considered in Congress, you could now incorporate into your legislative actions on CapWiz and segment your list based on what districts people lived in. And so the people who lived in districts for members that co-sponsored a bill would get one message, and those who lived in districts that members did not co-sponsor the bill got a different message. So, you know, send your member, your Congress member, thank you for co-sponsoring our legislation. Send your legislator, you know, an encouragement that they should step up and co-sponsor. And then after the fact, they would Thomas would be able to tell CapWiz who voted for and who voted against the bill. And so you could do what we call thank and spank letters, where you could send an email to members that voted the right way, thank you for voting the right way, and those that voted the wrong way, people who lived in their district, would send shame on you for not voting the right way. And these are all designed so that it would match your zip code and address so that you were sending that message to your actual member of the House, your actual senators, who at that point still had this notion and still tend to have this notion based on antiquated franking rules, which are based on paper supply, that, oh, I'm only concerned about what my constituents have to say, not people who live in other districts.
So is this the mid to late 90s at this point?
This is, yes, this is late 90s that all these developments start happening.
It's kind of incredible because you still have tools today that can't do that.
Well, I mean, all the advocacy platforms, and, you know, there are a whole bunch, you know, Salsa, Spark Influence, Engaging Networks, Phone to Action, CQ Engage, you know, they all have the ability to match by zip code. They all have the ability Well, not all of them have the ability to sort by voting records and things like that. But
that's what I was thinking, because before Sunlight, I don't know that there was a free... I've never heard of Thomas before, actually.
Well, Thomas is the official congressional database. It's free to... It's all public domain.
I'm surprised. I've 4 years professionally in the space, no one has ever mentioned Thomas before. Is it a free... Is it still around? Is it a free API?
Yeah. I mean, everything... It's the official online record of bills in Congress.
Wow.
Yeah.
You know, what strikes me thinking about back to those days when I was using the internet for my job was kind of the transition from a human-organized, cataloged information system into sort of just a free and open searchable pile of bytes.
Right.
And so an example would be, you know, Yahoo was, you know, the lead search engine because they had an army of people cataloging stuff.
And Yahoo was a directory.
Yeah.
Where not a search engine.
Yeah, and all of the places I used to do research at the Post, and all of the places I used to go were bookmarked websites of other librarians who had particular niche specialties who would, you know, spend their time telling you what the best places to search for what kinds of information.
And it's interesting to come full circle because those curators, not necessarily librarians, but amateur curators are now the heart and soul of social media.
But I would say that election, that first election in 2000 was kind of, I mean, that sort of coincided. That's kind of around when Google went public and when the internet exploded and when the concept that, you know, you could leverage this information in a much more efficient way seemed to take hold.
Yeah. It's interesting, though, if you look at that revolution in libraries, the transition from the card catalog to the online card catalog, while it seemed great because you could had all this search power and everything, you know what you lost? You lost serendipity. You lost, I'm going to find this book on the shelf. Oh my God, look what's next to it. That's interesting. Look what's on the shelf below it. Oh, there's a book I hadn't thought of. Ah, there's a topic I hadn't considered. Oh, that's really interesting. And the ability to find these related or completely different books that just because they happen to be in your line of sight when you're looking at a particular book, you lose that with a pointed search engine focused book search or a pointed search engine focused bill search.
So now that we're in the late 90s, how is politics then changing because of this technology?
Well, my favorite kind of transition is in 1992, Bill Clinton went to Connecticut when he was running for president and told him how much he hated the Seawolf how much he loved the Seawolf submarine because it was built in Connecticut, right? And then he would go to California where all the peaceniks were and said, "I hate the Seawolf submarine because it's, you know, part of that nuclear submarine fleet." And because there was no social media, because there was no digital media that allowed people to instantly share what he's saying at this event with everybody in the country, and then they go to this event and he says something the opposite and they get caught, he could get away with it. There was some newspaper coverage about the different messaging.
You're saying Clinton was less than honest?
No, I'm saying he was your standard pandering politician back then at a time when you can get away with it. But now you cannot. Now you end up with, montages that you see on The Daily Show where you go back and forth between he said this, he said that, he said this, he said that, and you show, you know, the classic formulation of the montage is, you know, the candidate debating with himself.
But I feel like it reached a culmination when Colbert coined the term truthiness, where it was almost, it didn't matter anymore, as long as it felt true, like in your gut.
It is interesting that it launched that way. And he had such an impact with that word that within a year it was introduced into the Oxford English Dictionary.
Within a year?
Yeah,
really?
I think so, yeah. It was one of the...
I still use it. Like, it has not left my...
I met somebody who just created a website called truthiness.com and truthinesscheck.com.
Truthinesscheck.
And it's kind of a fact checker website in alpha at this point. But, you know, it's about looking at these statements that seem like they might be true. Now, obviously, Snopes and Urban Legends and some of these other websites are set up to debunk a lot of these things. But this one is really fixated on political claims and you know, hopefully we'll be a deeper database on that.
So what's your main area of interest in terms of the evolution of this vis-a-vis politics? Like, is it how politics has changed, or how government operates is different, or how people get involved?
I think it's about the people. I think, you know, I've always said that the internet was a communications revolution, not, and that people who said it was an information revolution were selling it short, you know, because it's a revolution in how people share information, not about the information, but how people connect with each other to share that information. And the evolution of the internet, even very early on, even before the web was born in 1993, there was Usenet, which was all text discussion boards, but it was social media. And there was IRC, you know, internet relay chat rooms, and there were even early on there was See You, See Me, some really basic text-based with video interface. And it was really, from the very beginning, it was about the communication revolution, the social revolution in that respect. And so, for me, what has really revolutionized politics is the ability for citizens to become more informed and share their opinions with each other, so they become influencers of their own right, in their own right, as well as the ability to use social media to call out politicians in a public way that is far more effective, potentially, and seemingly in reality, according to the Congressional Management Foundation Social Congress research, than sending them a private letter or a private email. Private letters and private emails, they work, they do very well, but a member of Congress could choose to ignore it, could choose to open those emails the day after the vote, right? And there's no public scrutiny as to what they're doing. But if I tweet, 1,000 people tweet at a member of Congress to vote for a particular issue, or 1,000 people post on their Facebook page to vote for a particular issue, they can't hide that. They can't wait until tomorrow to look at that, because if they do, they're going to be looking at it a day after all the press and their constituents have looked at it. And that can hurt them.
Could you point to that kind of direct impact as maybe being a little paralyzing?
It can be if you don't recognize it.
I mean, it becomes mob rule at some point, and then nothing happens.
Well, you also have to remember that both sides can engage in that conversation simultaneously. And so there, I mean, I've been on the organizing side of a response to a Twitter hashtag campaign where I would organize people on the other side to counter message on a campaign that was coming out from the other side. And so in that respect, it isn't necessarily paralyzing by mob rule, because you're able to then see what's the balance between the two, and you can rise above the loudness of one side or the other.
Well, I guess I'm just questioning the benefits of this complete transparency. I mean, is it really the best way to run a government?
Well, I mean, this goes back to the arguments of one of my all-time favorite bloggers, Edmund Burke, who wrote in 1776 about the difference between the trustee model of legislating versus the delegate model of legislating.
Are you a Lockean or a Hobbesian?
I'm a Lockean myself. The rational discourse is the surest route to good policy.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea was, you know, do you elect officials to vote their conscience on what they think will be the best, which is the trustee model, or do you vote them to vote the will of the people, which is the delegate model? Now, I would argue that until social media and digital technology reached the levels that it has in the last few years, you could never really know what the public, what your constituents truly wanted one way or the other, in a sure enough way to make the delegate model actually real, right? I think I said this at an event the other day, that we've believed for a long time, 100 years or more, that there's such a thing as the national conversation. But the truth is, until social media arrived, it was a fiction. It were people talking over here, people talking over there. And while you still may argue that, you know, there are ghettos of conversation on social media where the left talks to itself and the right talks to itself, there are certainly opportunities for both sides to see what the others are saying. And there are many people, me among them, who go out of their way to bridge those conversations and bring them together.
So your view is that this is a watershed moment, sort of a once-in-a-millennium kind of thing that's changing.
Yeah, I really do think it's a total game changer on politics.
Well, what's the last time something like the Industrial Revolution? Is that what we're talking about?
Well, okay, so in general, yeah, the Industrial Revolution was a big game changer. The, you know, supposedly the Green Revolution was a big game changer.
Or the Civil War, or
the Civil Rights Movement was a big game changer. And I think, you know, interesting that, you know, Johnson, when he passed the Civil Rights and the Voting Rights Act, was saying, this is good for America, not this is good for African Americans, or this is good for minorities. This is good for everybody, not just for the people who are directly benefited by what's in the law, but for the society as a whole to be a better place to live. And that was a watershed moment, even if we're still not fully realized the vision yet.
How does, I know we're talking about the past, but it's hard to ignore, especially when we're talking about, no pun intended, but trumping Bernie Sanders in social media, which is the left's darling. It's almost like I remember the Ron Paul campaign and how it took over, you know, much of the internet during its peak. I feel like Bernie Sanders has done the same on the left. But it's hard to ignore the momentum that Trump has gained. But how do you contextualize, I think specifically the aspect of Trump's campaign, which is almost in anti-intellectualism and anti-rationalization? So the idea of the internet or internet being the great median, the great access to universal information. Suddenly, for the Trump campaign, information, direct contradictions don't matter anymore. Is it a more resilient campaign that is the product of social media to take advantage of its faults and I guess people's own interest in something that's maybe bigger than the latest tweet hashtag?
So I think you have to step back for a moment and just realize that the golden age that you're positing never existed. That the vast majority of voters before the internet paid attention to the presidential campaigns in the last 2 weeks before the election. And the idea that you could have then an electorate making deep decisions on policy based on 2 weeks worth of reflection is just impossible. And so there never really was a deep intellectual element to political campaigns before the internet. Now, in 2008, study from Pew Internet and American Life Project found that as early as June, 42% of Americans were paying attention to the presidential campaign in June. 42% in June, when it used to be the last 2 weeks of October, was when everybody would just start. So, you know, I'm not saying that they necessarily had that deep understanding, but they certainly were paying attention to it much sooner and had access to much, much more information that they could process. Now, I think obviously there's going to be a broad variation across people as to how much of that information they take advantage of. And sadly, you know, there was this sense early on back in 2008 that the candidates' commercials were among the most informative sources of information, or the best, greatest source of information for voters, which largely reflected their lack of trust of the media. Which is a sad thing for the media, not for the people, because I think in many cases they were justified. So now we have, you know, I'm giving a presentation this coming week in New York on hashtag politics up at Baruch College. And the question of whether or not hashtag politics is dumbing us down or not, I don't think so. I do think that it does create sort of superficial hooks, but it creates attention to an issue on that hook that lingers, and that when you see those hashtags, they're attached to statements and links to articles and clips of video. And
at least maybe it's not any smarter than it was, but at least there's the opportunity very easily to take a deep dive and educate yourself.
Yeah, and a motivation to do it earlier than ever.
Yeah.
Yeah, because it's so ever-present and it's there. So I think that access to information and the popularization of that information leads to the possibility and therefore the increased manifestation of people knowing more about the election. At the same time, though, you know, we know that people who listen to Rush Limbaugh every single day, people who watch Fox News exclusively, they think they know more about politics than anybody else, but they score the lowest on actual quizzes of factual knowledge. That's because the source of information they choose to consume is feeding them lies. And so you learn what you hear.
So going back to our timeline, what were you doing then in the late 90s? For me, because that's when I sort of got involved in the internet, and I went to a political startup, speakout.com, which
right,
was
I remember that.
Voter.com was another.
You were at Speakout?
I was. It was probably...
Weixler?
It was Ron Howard, not the Ron Howard, but a different Ron Howard. And there was probably three or four... startups that were pegged to the election.
You had, you had Vote Smart, and you had U.S. Politics USA, and a couple others like that.
So that to me was kind of a time when the campaign started spending real money on this stuff, and there was a business case to be made for providing this information or providing forums for communication and stuff. Was there anything that happened in that election that was different than had happened previously?
In the 2000 election?
2000.
I mean, yes.
Besides hanging chads.
So yes, indeed. Let me just say that in the 90s, I had the luxury of being a full-time faculty at George Mason University, which meant I could choose my research agenda. I had a salary, I had a job that allowed me to do that. So I didn't have to worry about making money off of the industry. I could be an observer, a historian, and an analyst of the industry, and it was a legitimate part of the job that I had. That gave me an advantage of being able to stay in and learn a lot about it without having to worry about, you know, turning a profit. In 2000, the big innovations in 2000 were the full-blown integration of digital media into the presidential conventions. First at the Republican Convention in Philadelphia, they had Internet Alley. So they had Radio Row and Internet Alley in the first media pavilion tent outside the first Union Center, which was the convention hall in Philadelphia. Internet Alley was the brainchild of Larry Papuro, who was the deputy chair of the RNC. And it had MTV had their new MTV News platform. ABC News had a stage there where Sam Donaldson and Cokie Roberts would live stream their political analysis show every single day. The BBC was there. Insight Magazine had teamed up with Apple for the first airport, which was a wireless modem with a 1,500-yard radius, and Cybernaut, a miniaturized computer company that made miniaturized computers that had a keyboard on your wrist and a CPU on your belt, both the size of an iPhone today, and a pair of glasses that had a lipstick cam pointing out one side and a little projector with a little mirror on the right on the other lens that gave you the equivalent of a 15-inch monitor. And they were able to send a reporter to the floor of the convention center to do live wireless streaming broadcasts. All I could think of was Al Franken's one-man mobile broadcast studio. In fact, I asked him when I met him several years later if he would come back to Netroots and dressed that way. He said if he won re-election, he would. So I'm calling you out, Senator Franklin. Franken, you promised you would do that. You said you'd come back if you won re-election, and you've won. So we need to see you with that satellite dish. And we had, and I was with a company called Media Bureau Networks, and we set up our whole studio there, and we were doing 4 live streamed talk shows a day from the convention.
Were people jumping on the bandwagon, and this was a lot of hype and no substance?
It was amazing. The Republican convention was different from the Democrat. I'll get to that in a second. At the Republican convention, everybody who was anybody was seeking an opportunity to go online. We got unsolicited interviews with Jerry Falwell, Steve Forbes Jr., Bob Barr, who introduced impeachment articles against Bill Clinton. Ted Nugent came in. Ben Stein. All this, and then we added a little bit to the mix where we brought in Schoolie D, the father of gangster rap, who was a Philly native and a friend of ours, and we brought him in to do a show as well, mm-hmm. and it was just incredible energy. You know, we did an interview with Jeb's son, George P. Bush. We're the only ones that did a streaming video interview. MTV used our footage, never bothered to give us attribution as they agreed to.
But is this having any real impact, or is this people sort of testing the waters and trying to figure out what to do with
this? It certainly was real content that was being watched by people. ABC was putting in, you know, serious amounts of work. Pseudo.com had a 360 camera in the convention hall. Mm-hmm. Now, fast forward a few weeks to the Democratic convention at the Staples Center in Los Angeles, and you see utter failure across the board. Number one, where at the Republican convention they put together a place where all of these outlets could, you know, be together and close together. Internet Avenue at the Democratic convention, the aisles between the booths were so wide that it looked like a ghost town.
Yeah.
Instead of having Pseudo do the 360 camera, the Democratic Party made that their own, and they put the camera up themselves and they ran that. And so you had the party running the entire digital outreach operation, and they didn't know how, as opposed to tapping into the varied expertise of all the different organizations and companies that were doing it at the Republican convention. Mm-hmm. And so it was a classic example of what was an amazing success in innovation and groundbreaking, watershed moment at the Republican convention became almost nothing at the Democratic convention.
Do you think that there was a benefit for the Republican Party because of that?
I don't know. I mean, certainly early on, the Republican Party at this point gets the reputation of being more sophisticated on social media, on digital media, because of this approach. But the Democrats also start at this moment their engagement, their full-blown, straightforward, direct engagement with this technology. And obviously, at this stage, we see the growing rise of the Democratic Party and the Democratic and progressive movement starting to seriously overtake and leave the Republicans and conservatives behind on digital and social media. Mm-hmm. And that goes on for a long time, and now the right is starting to catch up, although the left is still pushing ahead very, very effectively.
And in my mind, another watershed moment was the Dean campaign.
Yes, yes. So Michael Silberman at one point was the
he's now at Greenpeace still?
He's now at Greenpeace running their mobilization lab. He was the webmaster at Dean's campaign. And the way he tells me the story, he shows up one day and he discovers that there are 2,000 meetups across the country on this website called meetup.com, with thousands of people meeting every month to talk about how they can help elect Howard Dean president. They discovered this. And he went through this very interesting process, a little bit of social listening. So he was checking in, seeing what they were doing. And then after monitoring this, they reached out to meetup.com, and they were given sort of access to the back end, the ability to communicate with the organizers, to share agendas with the organizers, to start to coordinate. And then they started to coordinate to the point where they had a monthly conference call with the 2,000 organizers of the meetups. They started doing like all the letter writing campaign of Howard Dean supporters to voters in Iowa was generated and managed through a meetup kind of meetup structure. And so they started to do some really innovative stuff. Michael became focused on that. They brought in Nick O'Malley to become the webmaster.
Well, the big buzz was how much money they were making off of donations, online donations.
Relatively. You know, before that, Bill Bradley and John McCain were the first two to kind of break $1 million. I guess those were both after Dean. They were the first two to break $1 million. They were before, in 2000. First to break $1 million fundraising online. So Dean really, his real innovation was sort of embracing the social element of the web, which at that time was really centered
and organizing.
Right, but it was centered at blogs at that point. Since then, blogs have evolved into a subset of the media, and less about social media. A blogger. Most bloggers are aspiring or successful journalists. That their job is journalism, perhaps a bit more op-ed or a columnist, not digital strategists. Early on, bloggers were the early era of digital social strategy, social influencers. But as it matured and they were taken more seriously, they became, recognized for the real good journalism and real good op-ed writing that they were doing. And that's sort of been... And now with the tools being so easy to use, WordPress, Medium, Pulse, Blogger, all these different tools that emerged over the years, some no longer with us, some still doing very well, it became really easy to just set up a blog where then all you had to do was write good, interesting things and you'd be successful.
Is that all you need to do?
Well, yeah.
So is it fair to say that things happen every 4 years when all this money is injected and the campaigns are investing and innovating out of necessity, or is it?
It's a mix.
Is that
okay,
too simplified.
I mean, one of the big challenges of the 4-year big time political cycle is that. And this was a classic example. Michael Basick, who's now at Proof, which is the digital strategy or digital advertising arm of Burson Marsteller. And Michael, when he was an intern, sort of conceived of the idea when he was an intern at AOL of selling ads to politicians. So he's, as an intern, invents the field of political ads online. Where was I? Question again?
The innovation. Is it pegged around the 4-year cycle?
Yeah. So he was telling me that in the corporate sector, it's a continuous process. And even in the nonprofit sector, it's a continuous process. And so at some point, they learn that it works, that email works, or that online advertising works, and what the best mix of budgets are, what the best formats for the presentations are. And then they stop doing research because they know it works and they just do it. Politics is a 4-year discrete cycle. And so when it rolls around for the next election, there hasn't been a whole lot of research done on what works and what doesn't work because it's been 4 years since the last election. And so getting the political world up and running on the digital strategy was difficult because they kept asking for research and there wasn't any to be had because the private sector stopped doing it years ago because they got what they needed to make their decision. And the political folks still didn't get what they needed to drink the Kool-Aid. And so they kept pushing, kicking it down the road and waiting until later to get really fully engaged.
Mm-hmm. So what happens next? Where are we now? 2004?
So 2004, you end up with Howard Dean has the big kind of blowout in the early primaries and fades away. And what you end up with is John Kerry's campaign, which really starts to explore the whole idea of testing everything, testing the color of the donation button, to the point where I'm going to get the order wrong, but at one point early in the campaign, they discovered a red button was the best button color for the button to donate. And then they kept testing it over time. And then towards the end of the campaign, they discovered
an engaging candidate.
That well, that, there's always that, as John Stewart called him, the animatronics Lincoln. But eventually they discovered, oh, now yellow buttons work better than red buttons. So they switched. Yeah. So the idea not just of testing to see what works and what doesn't work, A-B testing on messaging and color schemes and layouts, but the acknowledgement that what works now may not work in a month. And that you have to keep testing. And the recognition that the technology allows you to keep collecting that data so that you can keep testing it. And so, websites, real websites, don't have launch dates. Here is our website. They have launch sites where we begin to use this platform and the website evolves over time. And now I think we get to the point where most people don't even want to interact with you on your website. They want to go to your Facebook page. They want to go to your Twitter profile. They want to go to your Instagram. They want to see what you're doing today. They want to see what you did 5 minutes ago. And that's where they want to engage with you, because not only can they engage with you, but it allows them to activate their networks to act on what you're telling them and have an impact in their lives and in their worlds. You know, go to a website and it's all about what can you do for us, the website owner. You go to social media and it's, you know, what can you do for us, the visitor to your social media page. It flips the whole thing on its head. You know, as I always say, activists, voters, citizens are no longer soldiers that you can deploy. They're now strategic partners for your campaign. And if you don't treat them that way, you don't get their support.
Sounds like a lot more work.
It is. But that doesn't mean it's not worth it. Mm. And it doesn't mean... And it is a lot more work, but if you don't do it, you're going to fall behind. You know, so it's not an option. Should I go down this route? Because, you know, at this stage of the game, for organizations that use social media well, it is the primary point of contact between them and their audience.
So the next evolution then is the jump into this a little bit more dispersed arena, which is not just your website, but all of these other social media.
So a web strategy should no longer be what does my website look and feel and do. A web strategy is how am I positioned across all aspects of the web and how do all of my outposts on the web interact with each other? And how do I serve the needs of my audience?
So what are people doing now? I mean, we talked about Donald Trump. It's just an opportunity to sort of have an authentic voice and engage more directly with people. Is it just a different platform, or is there something like substantively different about the interaction?
I think the days of the scripted candidate is dying. I think that
doesn't bode well for Hillary Clinton.
No, it doesn't at all. Hillary, I find her most compelling when she's unscripted. I love her when she's unscripted. When she's scripted, I find her uninspiring. Which is sad, because I know the person she is, the person who would actually be president, is the unscripted one, right? That's the one who's going to be doing the work. So I'm okay with that. But I get very frustrated watching her campaign, because she is so scripted that she comes across insincere, inauthentic. Go back to Bob Dole in 1996. Bob Dole came into that election. He was a funny man.
Yeah,
but he had a very acerbic sense of humor. And his handlers told him, oh, the voters won't like that. You should get rid of that. And so all of a sudden, Bob Dole became a different person, scripted, and all the charm that he had was gone.
Well, so that speaks to the ability to speak directly to the voter as opposed to filtered through John Brokaw or something.
And that's why when Joe Biden makes a gaffe, nobody cares, because, hey, Joe speaks from the heart all the time. When Dennis Kucinich says something funny, they go, well, you know, that's Dennis. He gives that, he's authentic. When Donald Trump goes on a tirade, they go, well, you know, he's passionate. This is Donald Trump. This is what he does.
Because he's the uncle that you know, and you sort of, you accept that
well, he's real.
Truthiness.
Real, like keep it 100, you know, as Larry Wilmore says, keep it 100.
Yeah.
Do you think that Hillary, because to get the nomination or from your party, you have to make it through primaries. Do you think, though, that for Hillary, it was her nomination to lose rather than hers to win, and the strategy was to play it safe, to be bland, because it was not
too... She was definitely playing the prevent defense.
So maybe once she has the nomination, then she pegs it, because the Hillary I see right now can't compete against Trump. Like, there's not a vitality there, there's not an engagement there, but the Hillary I see right now will win the nomination. So the question becomes, do you think, you can call it right now, do you think Hillary's campaign is gonna completely shift gears and go genuine Hillary after she gets the nomination?
I certainly hope so. I'm not convinced, given who's running her communication strategy, that
that'll be more of the same.
I don't know. We'll see. I've predicted that Trump was going to win the nomination from the day he came down the escalator. And or early on, to be more accurate, I said people should not discount him. This is going to be a serious candidate. You know, this is going to go a long way. And then very quickly, I was predicting that he was going to win the nomination. I also think that given his extraordinarily high negatives, that he most likely will not win the general election. But
give us your prediction now.
Who's in that context, now Hillary has near the second highest negatives of any candidate ever, and she's likely to be his opponent. And if she continues to be this scripted, then I don't know who's going to win. But if she is able to connect with the voters on the basis of who she really is, then I think her negatives will come down. The Bernie people will come over, because nobody on the left is ever going to be happy with Donald Trump being the president. And I think she will win. That's my prediction, is she will win.
Do you think it's she has to court the Bernie vote, the people that were supporting Bernie, or it's more about people in the middle that skew Trump?
Well, again, there's three ways to win an election. Win your base, turn out your base, win over the middle, suppress your opponent's base. So
is that political science 101?
That's pretty Professor basic. That's political campaigning 101.
It's like business 101.
And it's that last one.
Relationships.
Suppress your relationship. Yes. Dating advice 101.
The last one is the most anti-democratic notion, right? It's despicable, but it's the reason why we have negative ads. Negative ads are all designed to convince the people of the other party that the candidate that they have to vote for their party isn't worth getting out of bed for. Not that that's all it's about. It's about saying,
Can you correlate the rise in negative ads and the distribution of that message via the internet to lower voter turnout?
I don't know if we've had lower voter turnout lately. We've had some pretty good...
I don't know.
No, we've been having good voter turnout. I think.
Good for the U.S.
Good for the U.S., yes.
Still right. Pretty low.
Yeah, absolutely.
I feel like a non-vote should be a vote for a re-election.
So what's next? What's going to be the next watershed moment for us?
There does seem to be a resurgence in long-form content. Medium, Pulse. Parleo just got bought by...
Is there really a resurgence, though? I mean, of course, they're sort of de rigueur, but...
I guess, are people reading it, is the question. There might be a resurgence.
I don't even
know. Well, there certainly is a core group of influencers that are reading it, and they're turning around and influencing other people. But I think the big challenge here is, and this is something that sort of I pushed through with my colleague Brian Komar when we were at the Center for American Progress, was to convince the traditional politicos of the transformation of who constitutes an influential. Traditionally, the influential was the press, the policy experts, the lawmakers, their staff, the donors. Those are the influentials in the classic formulation of the model. But we now have the blogger, we have the social media influencer.
And this is correlated to basically the congressperson who's voting. Who are they listening to? What information do they come in contact with every day?
Right. So now the situation is we're seeing empirical evidence based on surveys of congressional staff that a member of Congress will start to pay attention to your issue if they get as few as 10 to 30 messages on social media about that issue telling them to pay attention within 12 hours of that, of something within a 12-hour period. If you can get that kind of simple, easy numbers to get to them, they start to pay attention. However, it varies from office to office, and Brad Fitch from the Congressional Management Foundation, you know, is often talking about this. You know, some offices, they're doing systematic analysis, spreadsheets of all the messages coming in, looking at the balance, the ratio, the strength of the messaging and things like that. And others are walking down the chief of staff is walking down the hall with the member on the way to the vote and says, this is what they're saying on Twitter, and they show them a tweet that sort of verifies the chief of staff's preference and says this is what they're saying. And one is very systematic and delegate focused, and the other one is much more trustee or misrepresenting, or as I like to say, a lot of politicians who think they have their finger on the pulse of the nation are using their thumb and listening to their own pulse.
But I mean, if you're looking at your Facebook page, I mean, that's obviously not a scientific poll of your constituents either.
But the truth is that members of Congress have never looked at a systematic poll of their constituents to make their decisions. They've always made their decisions based on which of their constituents are taking the time to contact them. And now they're looking at Facebook and Twitter, beginning to look at Facebook and Twitter as channels for that contact to be happening. It's entirely possible that more members and their staff will start to proactively look into what people are saying on social media in their district generally, rather than directed at them as a measure, which opens the door towards a more systematic looking at what people believe in than just simply
are there
the
tools out
wheel.
There where a politician could go on and say people with the hashtag, you know, taxes more generally, like something that analyzes, you know,
there are a variety
of
tools.
Tweets and categorizes them either opposed or against.
Yeah, I mean, there are a variety of tools from the most expensive content analysis tools like Palantir and Crimson Hexagon, less expensive content analysis tools like TechSifter, which are very good. Then down to I just did my column last week looking at a free tool called Hashtagify.me, Hashtagify.me, and it's, you know, just like it sounds, and you can put in any hashtag you want and see what hashtags are most frequently paired with it. And so I was looking at the difference between Never Trump and Never Hillary, and those two hashtags, Never Trump being an actual campaign, Never Hillary being a derivative response to that campaign. And what I discovered was the people who were using the Never Trump hashtag were primarily Cruz supporters, far-right conservative activists on social media, and mainstream Republican opposition. All of the opposition to Trump on that hashtag seemed to be coming from the right-hand side of the spectrum. Never Hillary was getting it from the Trump and Cruz people and the conservatives, and from the Bernie people. She was getting it from both sides. And I think that tells you something. Now, obviously, more people were tweeting using the Never Trump hashtag than were using the Never Hillary hashtag.
Just because it was a derivative campaign.
Partly because it's a derivative campaign and there was more effort going into Trump, but also because there's less hatred for Hillary than there is for Trump. A little less.
So what do you see exciting happening now? Is there something else that maybe is going to infuse the next campaign, or something that's going to happen this summer or fall as the campaign heats up?
I don't know. I still think that there's room to grow within the using social media strategically world. There are a lot of people that use social media. The numbers that use it truly strategically, where they have a goal, they have a strategy, they have tactics, they have analytics to measure not just how much buzz they're getting, but who's giving them their buzz. When are they getting that buzz? Mm-hmm. Is it indicative of voting? We know that. I mean, I think there's increasing evidence that suggests that search buzz and social media buzz can be a predictor of election results, primary results, the day after, in the days between the last poll in the field and the and the time when the polls open. I think that we've seen that. I know that.
So you could use that as like a election day organizing tool.
Yeah, you can definitely use it, or at least as an analytical tool. I think, you know, I mean, I've been talking very extensively about the idea of complementing survey and focus group research with social media content analysis, and then A/B testing of messages that you get out of focus groups and surveys after the fact on Facebook and Twitter to see whether or not people are willing to engage in the messages that they're willing to say they support in a survey in front of their friends. And I think that there's a lot of potential there for the message development to be able to go beyond to go beyond the, yeah, people seem to support this message, to people are willing to say this message in front of their friends and family. I think that that's where we really want to go.
Brian, what are you writing over there? Brian's taking
every good
notes.
Idea that Alan makes me think of, I'm writing down.
Okay. Right. I'll send you my bill.
We can go through them at the end if you want. No, it's, you know, we met with, Spark Influence today, and
Brian
really,
Fratkin, by the way, everybody, nice tool he's got there.
Yeah, really, really impressive. Not only from a functional standpoint, but, as anybody who ever has run a campaign, from a usability standpoint, and,
Brian, you know, should think about spending some marketing dollars in the podcast, sector.
Yeah,
we need a new beverage sponsor.
Sorry, Charity Engine, your bill's coming due. You know, this is a side passion of mine. CRM is where the rubber meets the road with campaign organizers, with digital strategists and influencers, and it just gets me, you know, hanging out with like-minded people, with folks in the space, gets all the great ideas flowing. And whenever we're working with clients, I want to make sure we're recommending not only what we can do, but what you should be doing that nobody else is. And so a lot of ideas in both categories coming up here. And I'm just, you know, I take notes when I listen to smart people, and we're hearing from one of the greatest right now. So getting lots of ideas.
Well, it's great. And this is one of the reasons why I like teaching. I teach graduate school at Hopkins and George Washington and American on the side, because I get to do classes where I talk about these strategies with students, many of whom are in early careers in this field. And so we really get to, you know, brainstorm and get their reactions. They get to test out some of the ideas that we talk about in class in their job and report back on how well it goes. And so it's really exciting. So I get the same charge in those situations that you just described.
You know, you were talking about long-form content, which is definitely making a comeback, with newspapers moving complete publications over to platforms like Medium. You have The Owl. Long-form, definitely not dead. One of the interesting things, though, seems to be at the same time ephemeral campaigns and media is coming around. So you look at like Snapchat, like it's there and it's gone. And there's something about
supposedly,
but in the consciousness, right? It's never to be looked at again, which is a lot like a tweet. Unless you do something wrong or something spectacular or you make the news, nobody looks at your old tweets for the most part, unless it's an aggregate through some type of, you know, Twitter fire hose.
I print all mine out and I save them.
Every morning I see Hemming reading his tweets, 20 pages of favorite.
He folds them into small pieces so that they're mobile.
they're mobile. They're on post-it notes. But I think it's, I don't want to say irony, but this duality of long-form content, of engaging with thought leaders and tastemakers, but at the same time, this idea of not only ephemeral content from a personal social media level, like Instagram, Snapchat, but from almost a campaign level, like you don't necessarily have a hashtag campaign that lasts 3 months. It could last a weekend. And
it varies. Some established communities that last for years.
And I think a lot of specifically nonprofits, I don't know about political folks, but a lot of nonprofits don't have the capabilities to jump on a campaign that's almost taken on a life of its own. And by the time they get their shit together, they've missed the boat.
Well, it depends on the organization. A couple examples: Human Rights Campaign, or
HRC?
HRC. It's yep. Campaign or Coalition?
Campaign.
Human Rights Campaign was doing the marriage equality campaign a few years ago, and one of their staff, one of their communication staff, came up with the idea of turning their blue background with a yellow equal sign logo into a red background with a pink equal sign, mm-hmm. red for, and pink for love. And it took off and went viral. Not only were people using it like crazy, but they were coming up with variations to Batman symbols and a whole bunch of other stuff. And to their credit, the organizers of the campaign, not just the Human Rights Campaign, but also some of their coalition partners in California and elsewhere, and their consultants, they saw it happening, and they said, okay, this was a peripheral element of our campaign. We're going to pivot and make it a central component of the campaign. And they shifted gears to focus on it and to focus on the spread of it. And it was the nimble, agile aspect of that campaign made it very, very effective. Similarly, when the lights went out in the Super Bowl between San Francisco mm-hmm. and Baltimore, there was a room full of people at Oreos, and you know, including the designer and the decision makers. And you know, the lights went out, and she came, and the designer started, and they go, "Yeah, oh, wow, that's great." And within like a minute, they went out on Facebook with, you know, you could still dunk in the dark with a, you know, a dark picture of a glass of milk and an Oreo cookie.
That seems to be the very dramatic exception to the rule. I'm just thinking like the branding,
but it's replicable if you choose.
Human Rights Campaign are like, those aren't our colors. You know, that's not what our branding guide says, but which is what 99% of the organizations right. in the country would do.
Right. So you have to be willing to embrace chaos. You have to be willing to think outside the box,
and let it
and you have to prepare yourself.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. And I've historically been known for saying message control is dead, and I've been, you know, forced to sort of, you know, well, maybe not dead, but the best you can really do is manage the chaos. And the saying that if you try to squeeze too tightly a handful of water, you end up with an empty hand.
I do it now.
So control.
Have you ever heard of that?
Control message.
I'm still trying to.
Yeah, squeeze too. You know, if you hold your hand loosely, you keep the water in your hand. If you squeeze, it goes away. It falls out. And this is the bottom line. That, you know, when you try to squeeze your message control too tightly, these days you lose control of it. The New York City Police Department tried to run this campaign after they got a new police chief and, you know, new policies and to try to curb police violence. They decided to run this campaign, My NYPD, where you would tweet a picture of you smiling arm in arm with a member of the New York Police Department. Unfortunately, they did none of the due diligence of preparing people to let them know change of leadership, change of policy, things are getting better before they ran the campaign.
Accosted on the street.
And so all basically people started using the hashtag to post pictures of police brutality from Occupy Wall Street, which occurred in the previous leadership, right? It's what they had fixed it.
Yeah, yeah.
And then Phoenix and LA and all these cities around the country started doing their own My LAPD, My PPD down in Phoenix, the same idea. And it literally started the national conversation on police violence that when Ferguson occurred a few months later and Garner a few months after that, there was fertile ground for them to take root to turn the conversation far more broad, far more impactful, far more to the point where it evolves into Black Lives Matter. And now that becomes an issue in the presidential campaign. Couple days after Bernie Sanders gets accosted by Black Lives Matter's protesters at Netroots Nation, supposedly friendly ground for him, he hires a new communications director who's from the movement, right? And it's become a mainstream movement focusing on, you know, so now we're seriously thinking about stopping the provision of military equipment to local police departments, which is part of the problem. So policy results are emerging out of this sort of evolution of hashtags over time.
Sounds like a reason to turn away from social media if you're a politician. Are there any big mainstream politicians who refuse to do anything on social media?
Well, at this stage of the game, I think every single member of Congress is on Facebook and Twitter. There were like four holdouts a couple years ago, and I don't think they're.
They might have an account. There's got to be somebody. Wasn't there somebody like one of the politicians famous to say he doesn't. He doesn't check his email or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, certainly some offices, it's the staff that
might be required to have it. It doesn't mean they're required to check it.
But I think I've often made the argument that the offices where the staff run the social media accounts mm-hmm. actually are better for activists who want their message heard by the member, because there's somebody whose job depends on reporting that information mm-hmm. up, as opposed to, you know, as much as I love the fact that Claire McCaskill tweets, if you tweet at her and she misses it, unless she has somebody monitoring it for her, mm-hmm. there's no accountability. She doesn't report to anybody on that level, right? The smart ones who tweet for themselves, who post for themselves, also have a staff person who's checking the stats and monitoring and managing the pages for them, you know, at least monitoring what the responses are. Even if you tweet for yourself, you've got to have somebody supporting that.
So, Alan, you mentioned the report earlier that 10 to 30 influencers, or not even influencers, just individuals reaching out on social media.
Constituents.
To their representative could get noticed. Is that only because they haven't become blind to that method of communication? I look at things like We the People. I look at petitions getting hundreds of thousands of signatures. Completely ignored. It's kind of lost its impactfulness. And tends to be the case that as media channels become saturated, as people become more effective in using them, they lose their impact.
So this was the argument that, you know, once MoveOn started delivering a million signatures, you know, 100,000 just wouldn't cut it anymore on petitions. The difference I find with social media is the public accountability elements of it. I think the differentiating factor between petitions and emails versus social media is that when I tweet at a member of Congress, the world sees it. When I run a campaign to get people to tweet or post on a Facebook page to a member of Congress, I can alert a member of the press to show them it's happening. When I send emails or I get activists to send emails or letters to members of Congress, there is no way for members of the press to be alerted or for the public to see those messages are being delivered and ignored. There's no way to see that, so there's no accountability to it. And that, I think, is a differentiator that makes it harder for there to be that, mm-hmm. you know, declining marginal return. It may mm-hmm. be that you need more and more messages I think that, you know, with a member of Congress, if, you know, you've got 30 people saying vote this way and another 30 people come saying, no, don't vote that way. Well, the issue's on their plate now. Regardless of which way they go, they're now considering the issue, which means that they're now open to lobbyist visits and constituent visits, and they're now attuned to the issue. Regardless of whether one side or the other has the lead at the moment, you've now put it on their agenda. And the most important thing to getting a member of Congress to vote one way or the other on a bill, the first step has to be to get it on their agenda. And if you can't do that, then you never get to the end step.
So that was going to be my next question. I was wondering if this almost necessitates the need for a multi-channel integrated outreach approach.
There's always been a requirement that you should do multi-channel. We know that in advertising, they have this notion called source amnesia. I saw an ad on TV, I didn't remember it, but then I saw the same ad online. I go, I've seen that before somewhere. I can't remember where, but because I remember having seen it, I'm more likely to get that ad gets more traction with me the second time I see it. In 1904, Sir Charles Sherrington did research on dog reflexes and discovered, you know, how when you scratch a dog on certain places of their body.
That was Pavlov.
No, well, that name rings a bell. But when you scratch a dog at certain spots, there's a pressure point where they start to scratch themselves reflexively and they can't stop. But you have to scratch that point above a certain threshold of stimulation. Then Sherrington found that there are multiple pressure points on a dog where you could scratch above a certain threshold and you would get the same reflex. Then he discovered if you scratch two or more of those spots below threshold, the combined effect would produce the reflex. The sum of the part, the sum of the parts was actually greater.
It's the magic fingers theory of political action.
Well, it's called the concept in psychology is called additive summation, but it's the same. It's analogous to that source amnesia that I described with advertising, and we've applied that when I was at eAdvocates back in 2005, 2006. We applied the same. I'm sorry, no, 2004 or so, we applied the same notion of using email, online ads, and robocalls to reach out to activists in order to get them to take an action. We ended up getting a much higher rate of action than just adding the typical response rates of the three different methods together. Normally, if you added the three together, you'd probably get like an 8 or 9% response rate. We were getting a 14% response rate. And then we were using multiple channels to send messages into Congress. Faxes, emails, phone calls, lobby day visits, lobbyists, earned media. And so when you use multiple channels going into members of Congress, you get more traction for your message. They're more likely to notice it. You're going to get more effectiveness. And I think that this has always been the case, but more and more people are starting to realize that that is one of the big advantages of social media.
Well, it sounds like you're a real optimist for the power of social media to change government for the good, or at least
I am. I think it's making people more engaged. Government. Yes, absolutely.
So if you were a student in one of your political science classes, where would you go to find more more information about all this?
All right, so a few things. I write a biweekly column at socialmediatoday.com called Social Advocacy and Politics, and there's probably 150, 200 columns there, ranging from snarky to very strategic, step-by-step how to do this or that. I think epolitics.com, which is Colin Delaney, one of your former guests, mm-hmm. has a great website and blog that provides a lot of good information on this. Some interesting things come about Tech President every once in a while, although they have sort of a broader, more intellectual approach to things.
Mm. How can people get a hold of you if they have questions? Or
I am available on Twitter, Facebook, everywhere at Dr. Digipol, D-R-D-I-G-I-P-O-L, as in Doctor of Digital Politics. Dr. Digipol. And, I'm very accessible on Twitter and Facebook especially. If you want to reach out and ask questions, and absolutely, I'm always happy to engage.
Well, this has been awesome. Brian, do you want to ask the
open question? Oh, you have a standard closing question?
Yeah. Did we not prepare you for this?
If you'd like to give a shout-out to any nonprofit that you're currently working with or have a particular soft spot for, you got 60 seconds. Who do you want to give a shout-out to?
I've always been a big fan of one of my clients, the Advancement Project. They're sort of a modern civil rights organization. They do litigation as well as policy work. They've drunk the Kool-Aid on using social media. They've brought me in to train people frequently. And they're also on the ground organizing Moral Mondays with the local NAACP in North Carolina. And so they just have that full scope, full range of consideration from online to offline, from litigation to policy advocacy, and they bring it all together in a very nice package.
Awesome. Thanks.
That's great, Alan. Thanks again.
My pleasure.